Jonathan talk. Yoda and welcome to Muffin Talk. Muffin Talk is a weekly radio program to which I invite guests to talk about their work and their passion for issues on community programs, social justice, or different religions. Today, I'm going to play a recording that I did for the Religious Diversity Center a couple of days ago. The interview guest is Rod Oram, and Paul Blaschke is asking the questions. Rod Oram is a New Zealand journalist and Newsweek weekly columnist. He's currently in Egypt covering the 2022 United Nations Climate Change Conference, COP27. Dr. Paul Blaschke is an environmental consultant with a background in ecology and environmental policy. He's a member of the RDC, the Climate Action Group. Here goes the recording.
Kia ora, Rod. Tēnā koutou katoa to all our listeners. And a special greeting to you and a big thanks for attending in your busy time in Egypt at Sharm el-Sheikh. And I know that it hasn't been plain sailing to get to Egypt and to be there. So really appreciate your time and your effort to talk with us and perhaps give us a slightly different angle from some of the great news reports we're getting from you and other commentators here in the media in Aotearoa. So I think some general impressions from you about this particular COP meeting. What's distinctive about this meeting as it's winding through? I think it's three quarters of the way through now. And in the setting, which I understand is only the second COP meeting to be held in a Muslim country.
Yes, kia ora tato, and to Paul and everyone, it's a great pleasure to be on the line with you. Indeed, this is the second time that it's been hosted in a Muslim country, but also an African country. Marrakesh, in fact, has hosted two previous COPs, going back about 10 years, as memory serves, and about 7 or 8 years. And this is a very important COP because here in Egypt, Egypt, of course, considers itself very much part of the Middle East, very much part of Africa. And so this has been very much considered the African COP, which is hugely important because whilst the population of the whole extraordinary continent of Africa is only about 1.2 billion people at the moment, over coming decades, this is where all the fastest growth in population, economy and emissions is going to be. And therefore, it's really important for the world to come around Africa and then support them to take a big leap forward. So they don't go through, old stages of fossil fuels and everything else to get to climate compatible economies and societies, that they leapfrog. And they have experience in this. So, for example, with phones, many countries had pretty dire landline phone systems. But when mobile phones came along, they leapt straight to that and became great pioneers in payments by mobile phones and things like that. So there's a huge excitement here about that. So that does make this COP different. And, of course, each COP is very much influenced by the mood of the time. And, of course, given the climate catastrophes that are escalating, particularly over this past year and all the geopolitics and everything else around that, that's very intense here. But it also reflects the host country, both in location the style of the host government, which is Egypt, which, of course, is an autocratic government. And so it's been far harder for civil society to play a role here. So NGOs and the like, who are terribly important, because if you think very crudely in terms of governments and business and civil society, these three great actors in all this have to work together. And it's civil society that keeps the feet to the fire of both business and government. So that's been marked here. And there has been talking to lots of NGO people. They do feel those pressures. Some of them are self-imposed, but all the same, they do feel constrained. Then furthermore, the pace of this COP is a lot slower than Glasgow. There are fewer decisions, there are fewer announcements being made, there are fewer decisions, there's far more unresolved issues have come through into this second week for the political leaders to try to resolve. And so it feels a very different COP, and that's just my perspective on two. But talking to veterans of far more COPs, those are the sort of themes they're highlighting. And so at this time of these ever greater climate emergency, that's not translating here in terms yet, we might, in terms of, big new commitments, trying to fast forward things. Having said that, the classic arc of COP, is that you've got this kind of all the way through the first, lots of preliminary stuff, then all the way through the first week. And then it's not really until you get into the second half of the last week, the second week, that's where negotiations get very intense. So hopefully we'll see now, it's only Wednesday morning here. By the time we get to the official close on Friday, which we won't meet, the COP will run on for at least a day or so afterwards. That's where, I hate to use the analogy or the language, but people start banging heads together to in a more constructive way. That's a mixed metaphor, if ever I've heard one.
Great. Well, thank you for painting that picture, which I can imagine is quite a frustrating one in many ways. So, just moving to some more issues, specific issues. Mm. So, I want to start with something that you've already mentioned, and that's the presence of civil society and NGOs here at this COP. So you've given us an overall impression of a lesser visibility and a lesser presence. A couple of specific aspects that I'm wondering about. Do you actually have restrictions on participation for the NGOs and civil society groups? Are there faith groups represented, which I know there was a very strong faith group representation in Glasgow? Liz, how many people there are under the age of 45, which I think is a very generous definition of a young person, but particularly in the actual delegations of the countries? Are those delegations old people's delegations?
No, it's. I'll deal with the age one first, because I think it's terrifically important. I was struck by this last year in Glasgow, that the median age of delegates, both in negotiations, in political roles, but also in business and in civil society, was young. And I didn't manage to get a median age out of the UN on that. Mm-hmm. But that's certainly true here as well. And you do see a few old hands around, particularly in the most senior political leaders, i.e. the climate ministers or the heads of state. But then, of course, there are still some quite young heads of state have been turning up here as well. It is very much people who are, say, under 45, who have the energy, the creativity. But also, I feel a greater ability to try to build coalitions, find unlikely partners to try to progress things. And I feel that my sense is that people are always scanning as to who can I find, who can I help, who could help me. And I find that sort of spirit of COP a very exciting one. So yes, there's a lot of younger people, and then that comes right down, particularly through the NGOs. And so from New Zealand, Rhiannon Mackey is here as a delegate, working with the New Zealand branch of Climate Action Network, which is a global organization. And I think Rhiannon is only just about 18. I'm not sure whether she's still in school or has finished school. The restrictions, as far as I've heard, are not overt. There are lots of stories of difficulties in getting badges, i.e. getting registration. Strange things do happen. Very interesting stories that when people are huddled together and it looks as though there's an interesting conversation going on, say, between NGO people. Cleaners or people wearing cleaners' uniforms drift towards them and are eavesdropping. No, seriously, and I don't think this is sort of a paranoia. Maybe we're just we're not paranoid. There is more control here. There's no two ways about that. Faith groups, yes. I'm afraid I'm nowhere near as well plugged into all of that here as I was last year. But for example, a very good interfaith group representing all the main religions has been holding a press conference every morning, usually at 10:30 in one of the main press conference rooms for half an hour. Everybody only gets a half hour slot with a big topic of the day. They have been very articulate and around all the themes that we know so well in the RDC about the role of faith in this. Very interestingly, being a Muslim country, you will find individuals, you will find small groups of people in not so quiet corners, because there aren't those there, praying to Mecca at various times of the day. People obviously are respectful of that and just sort of walk around them. But it's quite fascinating to see that. I mean, I know it's completely every day. It's part of people's life and faith. But it's really, I'd have to say, heartwarming that to see amidst all the hurly-burly of COP, people are taking those precious moments through the day to pause and reflect and to pray. And I feel we should all take a lead from them on that.
That's good. And just going back to what you mentioned about the faith group's press conference on the theme of the day, I just wondered if you noticed different themes coming from the civil society and NGO discussions that you've been in that are not being dealt with in the mainstream and not being reported. We're getting quite a lot of news back here in Aotearoa, but maybe some of the things that you're hearing on the ground coming from NGOs and civil society are not quite so visible.
Yes, indeed. There's obviously a vast array of issues in play here. For every issue, there's lots of NGOs involved. And all the very big ones are being well reported, not the least of which being finance for developing countries for loss and damage caused by climate, which they have managed to get onto the agenda officially for the first time ever in this COP. And that was a big breakthrough. It took them 40 hours of discussions and negotiations before COP started, in the days before COP, to get that onto the agenda. That's not flowing through, as far as I can tell, into sort of mainstream negotiations. They're still very much pushing, very much for their rights, and protections. And that's terribly important everywhere, but it's really important in Africa because the oil and gas industry is seeing Africa as a new frontier. There's already a lot of production here in Nigeria, a huge oil producer. But there is vast exploration going on and in very sensitive areas like the Congo Basin rainforest. It's indigenous people there who don't have basic rights. I saw a poster yesterday about consultation is not permission. And so there's sort of scant at best consultation and then people bowl in and take over their lands. So So, yes, there's lots of themes like that that are far from elevated and really brought into the heart of the negotiations.
And I do want to talk now about one of the major ones that you've mentioned, and that's the financing aspects and the loss and damage, and perhaps tease out some of the sort of social justice and climate justice issues behind those two important issues. I think just by way of background, it would be good if you just started off to our listeners. Some of you will not know exactly what's meant by this rather mechanistic phrase, loss and damage. Just give us a very brief scoping of what is meant by loss and damage and why it is so important.
Yes. Obviously, climate impacts are very real and they're accelerating. And so they are causing damage to all countries, not just to developing countries. So that's the damage part, is the actual physical damage. But the loss side is the economic one. Already from the changing climate and already the cost of repairing that damage. The economic loss from the changing climate is very significant. So there was a big report out from the V20 group of countries, the vulnerable 20. Originally, there's now about 65 of them in that group. A very, very good economic analysis showing that there are many countries that have already lost about 20% of their economic potential and ability to earn even the meager income they do because of the shifting climate. And then there's the costs of repair. And then there's the costs of adapting and making their economies climate resilient. So there's no hard number on what that might be, needless to say. On top of that, a number of developed countries, the US in particular, has made it very clear that they refuse to be held responsible for all the emissions they've already put up in the atmosphere that are causing the climate change. They are refusing to accept liability for that, and they're refusing the idea of any kind of reparations for that. So this, the only way they will proceed is on the basis is, from the goodness of our heart, here's some new money. It's not reparations. We're not admitting liability, but here's some new money. And on a positive side, though, there are some really creative structures going on here. But the basic concept is still a really important one of countries pooling resources to then apply them in an equitable, logical fashion. And so I think that that's a very important thing to look at, which does not get enough discussion globally and next to none in New Zealand. And this is the concept of a developed country meeting its Paris commitments, its NDCs, in part by investing in developing countries. So you're not reducing your own emissions. You do something in another country, and they I'll do something low emission or no emission, but you get the credit for that, not them. And I think there is a basic piece of logic that we have to hold on to here. Several big pieces of logic. The first one is humanity is right up against the limits on emissions. So we've all got to reduce emissions as fast as we possibly can. So we in New Zealand have to reduce our emissions. We can't just say, well, we'll let somebody up in the Pacific not create more emissions or slightly reduce theirs. So that's the first thing. And the second one is that, yes, of course, we need to spend money on making our economies climate compatible, climate resilient, zero emissions. But we've also got to find the money to help developing countries do that, because if we don't, they will become complete disasters, not just in humanitarian terms, but become even greater contributors to the climate crisis. So we've got to do both. And it feels to me that this idea of meeting your obligations in another country is a deeply flawed compromise. And the worst case scenario that our Climate Change Commission and government forecasting is that even if we do all the things they map out we could do, we will still be making very substantial purchases of emissions reductions elsewhere. The only other country that is very big on this is Switzerland. It's further ahead than us in many ways because it's developed a number of bilateral programs with, I think, about 6 or 8 countries. There are a few countries who are saying, actually, the Paris Agreement says 2 degrees, and we should stick to that. 1.5 was only an aspiration. Those countries are Saudi Arabia, for example, and other fossil fuel producers. On the current trajectory, that's one they can't. But I can't emphasize enough the importance for us all to keep that number absolutely right in front of us as we progress our own work, and to know that's how urgent it all is. That's how hard we have to work. That's how creative, how constructive we have to be.
Are you getting a discussion of and scrutiny of these targets, these net zero targets, as to whether they're real or whether they're greenwashing?
There was a very important, again, a high-level UN working group of which the chair of our Climate Change Commission, Rod Carr, was a member of, on greenwashing. And there are, it sounds terribly mechanistic, but there are 10 principles there, and a whole bunch of other stuff. It's a very good paper. And my colleague, Mark Dalder, a newsroom, wrote very well about that at the beginning of the week, last week. And it's well worth reading that piece. It helps, but there is still an awful lot of greenwashing. And for many of us, the argument has moved on from net zero because the actual task has to be reducing emissions, not offsetting them in some way. And so in that there is capacity from trees to absorb carbon, we need that capacity and all the new trees we can plant to actually absorb the carbon that's in the atmosphere now to bring it back down to more manageable levels, not to offset new emissions. And so we have to fight the net concept very hard and concede that there's a tiny, hopefully only a tiny last bit of emissions that need to be offset. But we can't just use net as a crutch, an excuse for not reducing emissions. And that debate livens up a bit. But going back to, and there's a lot of scrutiny of countries' NDCs. There's no two ways about that. But even in the very best scenario, if countries delivered all of the things they are pledging, even which is a ridiculous if, it would still be about 1.8. And realistically, current policies are still tracking more like, and delivery is still tracking more like 2.
Or even more. Yeah. Regard, Rod, has there been a lot of scrutiny of New Zealand's targets and New Zealand's performance?
No. New Zealand has an unbelievably low profile here. There are very simple ways of measuring that. So, for example, there is a wonderful Canadian NGO that for many years has been officially allowed to be inside meetings and to report on them, to help give a record of meetings and negotiations. Obviously, some of the sensitive political ones they don't get into. So the Daily Bulletin for that is a very dense document. And I do a word search every day on New Zealand, and there's hardly any reference at all.
It's us some perspective on how we feature. Why actually is there an annual COP conference with thousands of delegates travelling hundreds of thousands of air kilometres? Is it really worth it for that sense of getting together? Do they actually lead to any climate outcomes that are better than having a few Zoom meetings? Also related to this, in my correspondent, you went on to sort of ask about, well, what's the role of personal responsibility? You know, why should I be choosing to not to travel or to have a low emissions diet when there are all these other, you know, huge emitters going on? Is there any degree of introspection at these COP conferences, I guess, is what we're getting at?
Yes, there is. And I know from the conversations I have here, the people who come as delegates in their government, in business, in NGOs, the vast majority of them are deeply committed and personally. That's what keeps them going. I just feel it's such a core principle that humanity, each of us, has to take responsibility for our own emissions. Each of us has to do what we can. Now, we can only, each of us, do this infinitesimally tiny thing. But if kind of like an infinite number of us, well, 8 billion of us, did our infinitesimally small thing, then we've solved the problem. So I know that's a kind of a facile thing to say, but we do have to take personal responsibility. And I know I flew here and I take responsibility for that. And the only thing I can do about that is to buy offsets, which in this case is in the Pacific. You've heard my views on offsets, and here I am buying them, but that's the only thing I can do.
That's right.
But the benefit of being here is substantial. And I just want to tell you one story, because, and I'm going to get quite emotional about this. I was on the bus back from COP 3 or 4 days ago and was chatting to the person sitting next to me. He's called George from Kenya. And George had about 2 decades in the national parliament in Nairobi. But late in his career, he decided to focus instead on his local community. Because, of course, in Africa, they don't have the sort of governmental structures that we have in developed countries. An awful lot more falls to the role of local communities. So he is an elected official in charge of a county, as he called it, obviously a holdover from colonial times, of 1.2 million people on the shores of Lake Victoria. Well, thanks to the climate, the water level of Lake Victoria has risen 2 meters because of huge rains in the hills behind. But there is a huge drought in the 20 or 30 kilometers running from the lake back to the hills. And pastoral farmers, there's areas that have had no rain for 3 years. Pastoral farmers are rapidly losing all their animals and all the rest. So they've got all this water in the lake, but they can't get it onto the fields in this drought. And so he had come to COP just to try to look for answers and look for things he can take back to his community. And you can say, well, how could you possibly find that at COP? Well, aside from the negotiations, there's this huge hooey of humanity in the civil society side of COP. And there's NGOs, there's organizations, there's science groups, having very detailed programs every day of very practical things. And I should have taken George's phone number. I would love to catch up with him afterwards. They're going to track him down. There can't be too many counties with 1.2 million people around Lake Victoria. I'm sure I can find him because I want to know what he's found. And that's why people come together. There are still, my taxi driver from the airport when I arrived, who spoke very good English, told me there are still 6 flights a day from Moscow with tourists. That's, there's 45,000 people here. There will be a proportion who don't do much, don't get much out of it. But being here matters.
So far, the recording. To our listeners who are interested in Titiponamo Study and Joy, you're invited to join us for our December session on Stories, Films, and the Bible with Father Kevin Wildy. The movie we will talk about is The Father, a 2020 film featuring Anthony Hopkins. Join us for the session on Monday, the 12th of December from 7 to 8:30 p.m. For more information on this event and also any other current and past programs, please check out our website at www.studyjoy.nz. Kia kaha and keep safe.
Out there with pieces calling in the bonds of love we meet for the world a new day dawn.
Jai Sai Ram Srota Janu, Dar Raivar.